It is my real pleasure today to invite a friend to come down and join me as we sit and talk. His name is Chester Gould, and Chester Gould is, well, if I say, may say so, he's a very illustrious citizen of our community. I saw the other day in the newspaper that Al Capp had retired. Chester Gould just said to me, "Mal, I just left my drawing board." There's no thought in your mind of retirement yet, Chester?
Not one bit. I told you about just leaving my drawing board. I thought if you could have any graphite on you after we're through here, you know where it came from, Mal.
Chester, would you describe how you work, where you work, what kind of an environment you're in as you are working?
Well, creative business, which this is, most everything is, in art line and you might call entertainment. It's a form of entertainment, visual entertainment.
Sure.
I like to think that the comic strips were the first television. The newspaper had television before television did.
Yes.
I work in a very loose atmosphere, to tell the truth, but the hours are not loose. I spend a lot of time at the board, and when I'm not at my drawing board, especially this last couple of months, I mow a little grass. And the fact that the Lord grows grass faster than I can mow it, I'll tell you right now.
Especially this year, huh? This season's been great.
But I try to mix up my my indoor, my outdoor work, and it's worked pretty good for 46 years, Mal. It was 46 years. The 4th. When was that? Wednesday?
Tuesday. The 4th. Tuesday.
It was 46 years I've been writing and drawing Dick Tracy.
May we say congratulations. That was certainly one of the reasons during this week that I had hoped that we could sit together and talk about the way Dick Tracy has become a very live member of our world that we lived in. I said this to Bert Tilstrom one time about Kukla and Ollie, that these were not little puppets. These were real people. Well, Dick Tracy and B.O. Plenty and all these people that you have created are very real to it. They are real to you too, I think.
Well, yes, I would say that they have driven me out of my head at times. But they do seem real. I feel that while they're not patterned after any living person, I feel that if I looked, I could find them all somewhere.
Well, I've been told that some of these people of yours might even have lived around the Woodstock area, that there have been some very close proximities to living people.
Well, that is not true, Mal.
Okay.
I want to put you on it. For my films, I had a similar thing said to me one day, and this fellow with a rather severe little twinkle in his eye said, "Where do you get those villains?" And I said, "I look in the mirror in the bathroom every morning."
Taking yourself off the hook there, huh? Chester, what were you doing in the early, well, late 20s or early 30s? About the time that you began Dick Tracy?
Well, I'll have to go back a little before that.
Let's go back a ways.
I came to Chicago in 1921, and I had been a reporter and a sports cartoonist on the Daily Oklahoman and on the Tulsa Tribune. And I thought, "Gould, you've just got it made. You've had all this experience." Well, the truth of it is, I was extremely, still quite a good amateur, you know.
Yes.
So I took my samples to all the newspapers in Chicago, and first of all, the Tribune. That's where I wanted to land. And of course, the material wasn't quite what they wanted. They were very nice to me. And I finally landed a job doing commercial work, a small studio on the South Durban Street. When I say I landed a job, I sort of smeared on the rubber cement and swept floor and that sort of thing, you know, and erased the drawing. I was a glorified office. I didn't know it then. I thought it was good. But I went from there to cut the path down a little bit. I went from there to the Herald Examiner. The Herald Examiner, which was a very good Hearst paper in Chicago at that time. They hired me in 1922 to work in the advertising art department. The department consisted of two fellas, a wonderful guy named Bill Jennings, who was a very fine advertising artist, and myself. I won't describe myself because I couldn't fit my description to Jennings by any means.
Okay.
But he was very kind, very good, and I got a little experience there. And then the Tribune advertising department. I applied for a little more money all the time. I tried to make a little more money all the time. And my salary then went from $30 a week to $50 a week over at the Tribune. In the meantime...
The Tribune now is appreciating you after you got some experience,
well,
huh?
I guess so. I think most of them don't remember me being in there, but I was there about 6 months. So in the meantime, Mel, I had submitted, at least once a month, I had submitted a new idea for a cartoon. I had submitted first to the Tribune, and after they kept it a week and there was no dice, I would take it to the Hearst paper. And then I would take it to the Evening Journal, which you may or may not remember. That was
I remember the name, but...
Afternoon paper.
Okay.
Then I would take it to the Post, which went out of business. And I kept this round robin of stuff. Well, I had one batch of stuff in the hands of a syndicate or a newspaper. I would prepare another batch so that as soon as one batch came back, I would shoot the new batch. Believe me, I'm not kidding. That's the way I worked it. And naturally, it kept me out of maintenance. I was a busy little guy because I had a job to make a living then. On the Examiner and the American, I went through this whole thing. And so finally, I've given you pretty much the picture at that time. Finally, in 1931, the Tribune, Mr. Patterson, being the head of the syndicate, he and the colonel owned the outfit, and he had not accepted any of my ideas. I decided there wasn't one thing left to do. That was to clean out the criminal situation in Chicago. So I drew a few strips. I drew a week strips, and I very cautiously let one of the two or three of the fellows down at the News. I was on the News in New York, the Chicago Daily News. Look at this, and they said, "That is too rough. You'll never sell it." Well, I hadn't sold Patterson up at that time, so what did I have to lose? It was called Plain Clothes Tracy. I have the original six strips that I sent there. They're at home now with that big plainclothes Tracy lettered on the front.
Yes.
So I said, if he doesn't buy them, all right, but I'm going to send them down. Well, framed in what we call our little rotunda is a telegram that came back. I sent them in June and in August. I got a telegram saying, believe plainclothes Tracy has possibility.
Signed Patterson.
J.M. Patterson, see my secretary for an appointment when I'm in Chicago the 20th. So that came to our home in Wilmette.
You lived in Wilmette at that time?
We lived in Wilmette.
I see. Well, you were married at that time?
Oh, yes.
What did Edna say?
Well, the telegram came, and Edna, the art director, said, Gould, your wife's on the phone. So I went over, and it was Edna. And she read that I was working for it. I got to tell you, I was working on an old rug for the old rug company. Now, if you figure a cartoonist having an inspiring job, it's trying to draw an oriental rug.
No, I don't think that's probably where you really want to spend the rest of your life. No.
But I was working on it, so I got up. I thought perhaps she was going to tell me something about the evening, going to dinner or someone coming in. She said, I'd like to read a telegram. I said, all right. I'm not dreaming what it would be. So, and she read the telegram. And I said, okay, I'll be home on the regular train. I went back, I picked up my pen to the rug. Now, that's about all I said. We didn't talk at all. And a delayed action play for I got back after 10 years. And I began to sweat and sort of quake. And I took the oriental rug and, I handed the guy next to me. I don't know what he did. I didn't care. That's the last only oriental rug I had. But I went down to the cigar store, the soda bar. I had a Coke. I think I had a dish of ice cream. I bought a couple of cigars. And I don't remember much, but I finally got home.
Big celebration, huh? A Coke, some ice cream, and two cigars.
But that was Dick Tracy being born. Or Patterson, when I met him on the 20th. He a wonderful guy. But I went out and bought a new suit.
Well, certainly.
I went out and bought a new suit, new shoes.
New necktie.
I couldn't afford it, but I bought them.
Yeah, sure.
New necktie. And I think I bought a new hat. And I went in Mr. Patterson's office on the 24th floor. Mr. Patterson got up and said, hello there, how are you? And I said, fine. He had no necktie on. He had on a pair of army shoes that were, you know, the tap kind. And in all respect to the man, I'll say he didn't have polish. He was as informal as you can get in those days. He didn't digress on my history. Well, he knew my history. It tormented him. See? But he said, I think the title is too long. We'll call this Fred Tracy, Charlie Tracy, Dick Tracy.
You said that.
No, he did.
He said Dick.
He did.
Ah.
He said, no, I named him Plains Tracy.
Yes.
He said, we'll call him Dick Tracy. And he says, I'd like for you to get at least to that done by the first of the month to send to New York for the syndicate to prepare, to start to get ready to syndicate. Well, that gave me about, from the 20th to the first of the month, gave me about 10 days, 2 weeks of work. I don't remember sleeping in those 10 days. Oh, I must have dozed now and then. But I had the 2 weeks ready. And, well, the rest of it.
Did he give you a direction he wanted you to go? Did he guide you in any way?
Yes, he did this. This is rather important. I'm glad you asked that. He said, I have this fellow Tracy. He is not a detective. He's just a guy, a real nice fellow. And he said he's calling on Tess True. The story is calling on Tess Hart. Her father runs a delicatessen. They live up a second floor over a delicatessen. He says, have every night, old man, when he closes up about 8 o'clock, he takes a day's receipts upstairs in a little tin box and under his bed. He said, that night, as crooks learn about this. So while the evening of Tracy going to pose marriage to Tess, and before they sit down to dinner, the crooks come in the back, stick the old man up, take the box of money, and he fights a little bit with him, and they shoot him, and he dies right there. They kill him dead, right? And over the body of his dying father, Tracy is sent to swear, I'll catch those. And worked so hard on the case. The police chief, his name was Brandon, as you'd make it, said, I'm going to... He didn't send him through the usual channels he used before, and that's Mr. Tracy because...
Wow, what a fascinating thing. Chester Gould is obviously my guest, and we'll come back to this discussion with him on this anniversary, 41 years of Dick Tracy.
46.
I'm sorry, my mathematics are terrible. 46 years of entertaining, and at the same time doing more than entertaining, talking to Americans about a lot of very serious things, but done on, would you believe it, the comic page. Chester, you brought down with you some big books, and I think there are some things I see across from me. It says the Detroit Sunday Mirror, 5 cents. Some of these pages are beginning to yellow with age. Would you just take one of them, or you want me to see something here, all right?
First Sunday ran in paper, which we at that time owned, the Tribune owned the Detroit Mirror, and they eventually, within a short time, sold it. They had some bartering with, I think, Bernard Fadden on Liberty, and they got that in place of, he got Liberty. But it started October 4, 1931.
That's the first Sunday?
First Sunday.
Edition of Dick Tracy, okay.
And a week from the next Monday, which would be the 12th, the Daily started in the New York News, October 12, 1931. And that page, what's the date on that one there?
September 4, 1932.
Well, Tracy has been on the front page of that paper since that date. And if I can, I hate braggarts, and I'm not bragging, but I believe I have set a record for being on the front page of a New York Metropolitan Comics section at 45 years.
It's an incredible history of longevity. Things don't last that long. They burn out. They wear out. They get tired. People get bored. A generation would reject it. And yet here, look at the generations. Here it is, New York, Sunday, September 4th. When Kenneth Greb and Marge Dale found themselves confronted by the huge grizzly bear, Greb ran for his life, leaving Marge behind. Tracy came on the scene, and after pistol shots had failed to stop the grizzly, snatched up Marge and scurried across a log over a nearby ravine. As he's carrying her across the log, he says, I've got one bullet left in the gun. I'll have to use it. True to his reputation, the detective's aim is truest, and when the situation is tensest, and the final shot goes straight home. I couldn't fail. It was our last hope, says Dick Tracy. Dick, what's that? Listen. It's a roar like thunder. Let's go down where we can get a view of the other side of the mountain. An avalanche of stone. Look. Listen, there's a voice calling for help. In the distance they hear, help. It sounds like Greb's voice, says Dick Tracy. Like some mighty hand, fate at last has caught up with the fiend Greb, the blackmailer, the coward. Dislodging a boulder in his flight from the grizzly, he is borne down by the avalanche of rolling stones. It's too late, Marge. Nothing can help him now, Dick. Meanwhile, Marge's father and the highway police, having followed the trail, approach the scene. Father, are you all right? Yes, she's all right, but Greb is done for, I'm afraid, caught in an avalanche of stones. Well, look who's here. And Dick Tracy kneels, and there's a tiny bear cub. Look who's here, young fellow, with your mother gone. You'll need somebody to look after you now. You'll make a good mascot for the boys back home. Iron-jawed Dick Tracy with a heart of stone.
the way you ran down, I'd like to hire this fella. I can do it.
Beautiful. It's fun to read. It's really great fun to read, Chester. Well, tell me about this man, Dick Tracy, as you've developed him over the years. If you were to give him a little biographical rundown, who is he?
Well, he's a... I try to think of him as an ageless sort of fellow that appeals to all groups. Just as in your business, I think I'm going overboard a little bit, but I hope not. You must appeal, Mal, to everyone, to a certain percentage of all types of people. I know I have to. I want to get the child with an action picture when possible. I want to get the teenager with somewhat the same material. I want to get the a young adult and the middle-aged. You have to have a mass appeal to really get big. I mean, that's what the General Motors and the DuPont and all these babies that sell stuff to us fellas, they got to hit everybody. If you appeal strictly to the PhDs or to the opposite end, you miss a lot of people in the middle. And they say, well, gee, I never read that thing, I don't listen, or I don't whatever. But Tracy, in my mind, was, at the time I created him, my pattern, perhaps, was trying to recall what Sherlock Holmes would look like, because that was one of my idols, always. If he were... in this country, a young man probably wear, as was his style, and a snap brim hat, and have that same chin that Holmes had, and he wouldn't be smoking a pipe, of course. But I tried to model the face so that I could pick up some of those features as a young man.
The strength of the jawline.
The do or die and never give in, you know, that type of thing, and always on top. This was in the age when the positive was the master of our lives. You work for the positive. Today, there's a little bit too much negative, as far as I can. There's an awful lot of reward in being good at what you do, as well as being good personally, and being on top all the time, being the best. I told a young man, you know, I'm getting to be an old school teacher. There was a young man that was mowing my grass out there one day, and I said, he was doing a very sloppy job, and it was a hot day. I said, you know, I just wanted to tell you something. You're a fine young fella, and you got a great future ahead of you, but always go at anything you do. Do it better than all the fellas that you know. Try to outdo all the people that you know. And he said, I never thought of that. I said, well, you'll find that your father and mother will think it's great, and they'll look up to you, and they may even give you an extra slice of pie at supper table or something. I mean, these things, that's what makes people grow. They do a thorough job, and they get rewarded. I said, if you do sloppy work all your life, you won't have anybody to look on. You can't look at yourself in a mirror. But if you do a great job, do better than the next fella, you're your own reward. So that's about the way I talk to him. And he took it very nicely. And I thought a little later, I was shooting off my mouth this way. I'm liable to get some pretty sharp answers one of these days. But that kid, George, he worked around our place there for about 3 months, and it's surprising what it did.
Did it improve him?
I think they don't see these.
You just said something to the effect you're beginning to sound like a school teacher, Chester. I think, as I said a moment ago, you had an axe to grind when you started Dick Tracy. You were speaking to a point. Now, admittedly, it's a cartoon strip, but you chose crime, I think, because you wanted to talk about crime in this country, didn't you, honestly?
Well, I felt that it could be talked about pretty thoroughly in the 20s, and perhaps your statement is correct. I had no idea of being a preacher or a moralist, but I was raised with the firm conviction one of the worst things you can do is be dishonest and a shirker and have a crime, be involved in criminal activities. That's the same as being dead when I was growing up. So it would work out, I presume, it would work out naturally that I would think of these things without trying.
Do you plan an event, a kind of a scenario or a script months in advance for Dick Tracy? Could you explain to us a little bit of how you set it up? I should think in 45 years, you...
It's 46.
46, my Lord, I keep losing a year. 46, okay,
I stand corrected. Yeah, we got a team.
I should think you'd get tired and say, I've done everything.
Well, I was just telling a lady out there I talked to briefly, you'll be surprised what you can do when you've got to. I got this job after 10 years of trying, and I said, I've got to do it. I have to. You can make yourself do things. You can absolutely make yourself do things you never dreamt you could do. But the desire and the incentive and the urge has to be there. When I got this strip, I said... Here I worked 10 years to get this. Patterson's given me the chance. I only hope the Lord keeps me able to do it for a year so that he can see it was worthwhile. Even though it was brief, it was worthwhile. Well, I seemed to develop a little steam as I went along within myself. And I said to myself, I've got to have a Sunday page and a new story next Monday. So I got a new Sunday page and a new story by next Monday. People say, well, you have an imagination. You were blessed with that. All right, I was blessed with imagination, but it's surprising what you can imagine when you really want to and when it's your career. Imagination is, in my estimation, it's concentration and application. I think that's what makes imagination.
With you, it seems that you not only have the writer's talent to imagine, as you say, to come up with plots, but you also have the artist's ability to then put it on paper in a picture form. The two things that are so important.
Right.
Now, how long does it take you to... I read one page there. That would have been the page on the New York paper for one Sunday.
Well,
what's your average time?
May I tell you that in just a moment? I just wanted to say that you said you have to have two things, ability to write, ability to draw, which is absolutely basic. I mean, that's obviously so. When I was 12 years old, I enrolled in a correspondence school. I was in Oklahoma, Pawnee, Oklahoma. And I sold papers and got myself a little dough. And I enrolled in a correspondence school that would make a cartoonist out of you in a week, you know.
Yes, they still have those ads in papers. I still see them.
Well,
I'm sure.
This fellow, W.L. Evans School at Cleveland, they made no such claim, but they indicated that prosperity was yours within a short time. But I really applied myself, and I will say this, for this course, I think it taught me how to handle a pen. It was terrific. They gave you all kinds of little exercises. But anyway, now, getting back to writing a page, I have this ruled up, this blank ruled up in panels. And we have this, we have a paste up of this. We have a glued piece of paper we put the title on every week. And so I'll take this blank paper after I've decided and hit on a theme. You have to have a vehicle.
Sure.
Got to have a vehicle. Then I will write in longhand every word that you see, and I'll erase it, and I'll redo it. It's pretty messy before I get ready to draw. But I actually put word for word into this thing. I do my writing right here, not with the typewriter, but in longhand right on the page.
The captions and the conversation.
The conversation.
Come first.
Just exactly the way it shows up in the finished drawing. Then when I've got those balloons properly written and I feel that it'll make a good page, I spend about 4.5-5 hours drawing, inking in the figures and getting everything set. And the strips, of course, they're a different story. Now, this thing has to be done. There's one of these every week, long as you live. No 4th of July or Christmas vacation. These must be. Then there are 6 dailies. I try to get 2 high spots in the story each week. I exploit one high point in the dailies, and the other high point is in the Sunday page, so that there are actually a week, there's more or less 2 climaxes a week stuff.
Have you ever been sick? Have you ever been at a point where you couldn't work any time here? This is this tyrant, this demanding devil that keeps saying, it's a deadline, it's a deadline, it's another day, it's another week. How have you lived with that?
You said something is almost a naughty word. I don't know what sick is. I mean by that, you can't get sick in this business. You can't get sick. The nearest I've come to it is a severe cold, and I did go into the hospital and get my gallstones taken out about 1958. I was only in there 7 days.
You take your drawing board with you?
No, I'll tell you what I did.
What did you do?
I sat up nights working for about a month preceding this so that I wouldn't be behind when I got out. You have to have a product 365 days a year. Now, if you can do them all in 6 months, all right. Or, in my case, if it takes you 370 days to do 365 days, I cannot rush my material. I have to take it in reasonable time.
You can't just jam it all in over a few weeks and get it done for the next 6 months.
That's why I don't write ahead. Mm-hmm. People say, well, don't you write the whole story, don't you? And if you sit down and try to write a story, especially a cartoon story, you'll take shortcuts that you wouldn't think of taking. I know because I tried both systems, but I tried to do 1 week at a time and always have the last panel, have the hero in a fix or have some sort of tension
yes.
that you can't possibly get out of or figure how to get out of. But comes the next week, you have to.
Called the cliffhanger, huh?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do you have any help? Is your work such that you can bring people to help you do it?
Well, I have one assistant who's been with me several years, many years, in fact. Rick Fletcher, who does my lettering and my backgrounding and colors the page. I do the writing and the drawing and the inking in of the figures and all. And he puts in the lettering in the background, and there's color stuff to take care of. We have to do a color chart each week. There's a lot of little jobs in this business that don't show in the finished product, you know.
You've never had a manager, a publicity director, a PR firm? Or...
Come to me, I'm the guy.
You're it, Chester Gould, huh? Under one hat here, huh? Excuse me just a minute, Chester. We'll come right back to our discussion with this most interesting man in just a moment. Chester, how has the world reacted to Dick Tracy and Tess Trueheart? Do you have fan clubs? Do you get fan mail?
Well, I presume I've had a few, but primarily in this business, your big interest is in the letters you will get from kids asking you for a sketch or an autograph. That is sort of our barometer. I don't travel around the country. I have no public appearance program. I never have. It takes too much from you. And I started that. I got to tell you a funny story. Funny. I don't know if it's funny or not, Mal, but...
Try it on me.
46. We got
46. 46, right.
Well, anyway, we came to Woodstock in 35. The big school out here was the Todd School.
Todd School, sure.
Todd School. And the master there was a very nice guy, and he asked me to come to a country school, which is now a home on 120, on Queen Anne Road and 120. That was a school. He asked me to come up there in the evening and draw a picture for the fellas and girls, and which I did. I began to get... starting the next day, they called me somewhere else. Pretty soon, I was going out about 5 nights a week.
Drawing little pictures, huh?
And the story, bless their hearts, the story was, you'll only be here a half an hour. All right, so you have to dress up. You have to get in the car. You have to get there a little before the time. And then if you get through, autographs are being signed. And I always tried to do this. So you go out about 4:30 in the evening. If it's a 5:30 dinner, you get home about a quarter of 12. I had to stop stuff, absolutely. Well, about this time, my dad and mother moved up here from Oklahoma. And she had heard from some of her friends what a nice little guy I was. I'd draw pictures and I would talk. And mother said, would you please arrange to come before our group, our church group, next Monday or whenever it was? And I said, mother, you're breaking my heart. I said, I can't do it for you.
For your own mother?
My own mother. Yeah. I said, I declared out of that about 6 months ago, and I said, I just can't do it. She understood right away. She said she knew that I was busy pretty much in the evening anyway, this stuff. But you can trap yourself, you know.
The demands on your time, the pressures.
You can't please one group and antagonize the other. And it's very easy it's only human to say, well, gee, we must not be good enough for him. He went over to so-and-so.
Chester, you've been credited, the wrist radios and the devices of the detective and police world. Where do you get those ideas now?
Well, there again, that's a demand that is made on your imagination. The two-way wrist radio, which is now the two-way wrist TV.
Yes.
The result of the development of the transistor. Now, the transistor, which was unknown till near the end of the war, was originally developed by Western Electric and used in the walkie-talkie during the war.
Yes.
Well, they came back to this country after the war. They came back with these walkie-talkies, which would work once in a while. They weren't the perfected thing of today. Their range was not too great. And I said to myself, now this is Gould all alone working on his, you know, got to get a Sunday page. I said, if those things are that good, why can't I have a little transmitter, one not only will receive, but will transmit with atomic power? I didn't know what atomic power was, but they landed one of those things on top of Japan. I said, if it has to do with whatever this nuclear stuff, they're bound to get some power in a little package. So I designed this two-way wrist radio, and as you well know, the transmitting part has not been properly yet developed, but they've had the small receiver for Kingdom Come, since the war, and that was my venture into electronics, was trying to put together nuclear bombs and transistors.
You're sort of an inventor on your own right here, then, aren't you?
The nice thing about this, Mel, is I only have to draw them. I don't have to build them.
Yes, you can make a work on that piece of paper. That's fine. What do you and Edna, how do you live? Would you explain that to our audience? I'm sure they'd like to know. Do you go out a lot? Do you stay? Are you a recluse? What is the Chester Gould life like, other than what we know here on the drawing board?
Well, it's a very simple story. I have the dearest, most wonderful wife that a man could ever have. And she is perfectly willing for me to set the course on our social contacts. The reason that I have to make social contacts the way I do, very briefly, is that I'm either going to be we're going to either be social butterflies, or I'm going to get my work done. I mean, it's just that cruel. So she has very willingly and very inspiringly, as far as I'm concerned, she says, whatever you do, do it first, and then we'll get out when your work is done. So we belong to two or three clubs that we go out to dinner with friends, and we have our own family from Geneva down near Elgin. We have them up most every weekend. And we just have a lot of fun, but we can't go out. For instance, we love the country club, Woodstock Country Club, but we simply can't go out there like we'd like to attend that and have old Gould able to go at his drawing board next morning with vim and vigor. But we do go. You may not see us for a year or two. It just happened. It doesn't dovetail. You know how things that way happen. But we go out to dinner quite often.
Do you have a target date for retirement? Do you ever think about it? Is there anything in your life that you would like to do that would preclude putting down the drawing board?
Talking selfishly, I would like to throw the clock out the window. I've never been able to do that. I've watched a clock since I can remember. As long as I can remember, there was never enough time.
Yeah.
But I think if I did retire, if I got out of this business, I think Edna and I still have enough energy and desire that we would take some trips. And we love our home so, Mal. We just love to. We're homebodies. I guess that's it.
When did you come to Woodstock? Now, refresh me on that once again. You lived in Wilmette, and then you moved from Wilmette to Woodstock?
Yes.
When was that?
That was September 1 that we moved bag and baggage. September 1, 1936. We bought the land in 1935. And practically moved out. We were out every weekend and sometimes in the middle of the week. And we had a place to sleep and had provisions and all that stuff. And I really should say that we moved out in late 35 because I think it's an honest statement. But we lived in Wilmette. That was our home address until 1936, September 1. Edna's father was a builder. And I had a lot. I bought a lot. And he built us a lovely house. I bought my lot in Kenilworth, however, and it was getting a little bit rich for our blood up there then, so I sold that lot. He located the place for us on 17th Street in Wilmette and built the most beautiful little Spanish-type home you ever saw. And we had the pleasure of turning that over to Edna's brother when he got married. And that, incidentally, was in 36 when we moved out here. So we handed him the key to the house that my father-in-law had built for us.
Did you design your present home in Bull Valley when?
That we made several improvements from 35, and we finally tore down about 90% of what we had done and got John Anderson to put the present house up.
Oh, yes.
And with tongue in cheek, he gives me a lot of credit, but I want to tell you, we harassed that poor boy plenty.
Tell you what you wanted, huh?
He told me, he said, you're the most helpful people, because we would help him with figuring out things, you know. Edna inherited some of that stuff from her father, but at the same token, we were very demanding. And we had a pool that we had built in 47. And it was out in the yard like all pools are. Lovely setting, and a little wall up on one both sides of it. And John undertook to cover that, and he did cover it. He put up I don't think the rig building had any more steel. But it's solid, just like the Rock of Gibraltar, and it has heat in it, although it's very seldom, except in extreme weather, that it has to be heated in there. The south side is a plexiglass roof. Mm-hmm.
Solar heating a little for you. Chester, I hate to interrupt this this discussion. This hour has gone by much too quickly. I wanted our listening audience to have a chance to get behind the twinkle that is in your eyes. I wanted a chance to sit on this side of a microphone and look at your face and look at these hands and project the personality of the man who for 46 years has been tops in his field. That's a tremendous record and a tremendous achievement. You've meant an awful lot to an awful lot of people from one generation to another. And I am proud to know you as friend, know you as neighbor. And to you and Edna on this 46th anniversary, I ought to have a little loving cup or something here. But I'll just say thank you for the millions of people who've enjoyed your work. Thank you.
Well, Mal, those are the nicest words that will ever hit these ears. I have had it. You have really let me have it, and I want to thank you for this hour.
Come and see us again.